one of the big things is I've talked to a number of you about projects which will require images that maybe we don't have a whole lot of in our data set. Like maybe, for example, stop signs, road surfaces, traffic lights, automobile taillights. These are actually all very good projects. There's a really trivial way to get images if you'll work together. For those, you don't need a motion picture. All you need to do is probably go out with a digital camera, you walk around a couple traffic lights, you take pictures from different angles, or if you want to take pictures of asphalt and concrete, you know, you just walk around and point down, and just an hour or two's worth of walking with a digital camera would probably give you 100+ images. More than you would ever need. So, and I know some people have indicated, how many people are interested in stop signs? Anyone here? Heck, there's 5 or 6 of you already. You know, if each of you took 20 pictures or went online to Google, you'd probably have more than enough.
Yeah, there's plenty.
But the things I've heard so far have been road surface, which, by the way, how many of you were at the seminar today? Good. Did you notice in his movie how it picked up all of the gravel? By the way, that might be a great application for neural nets. Find gravel. You think at times these are interesting projects. I'll give you a really tough one, which we're not going to do for this project. Okay, mathematically define a hole in the ground. Mathematically. I mean, how are you going to do it with a robot unless you can define it? And a hole in the ground, you know, a nice drilled hole in something, that's much easier. That's too simple. I want an amorphous hole. Like you're digging a hole with a shovel or a backhoe. Not easy. Gravel's one of those things, but you could perhaps learn a texture. Okay? There are applications, but let's see. There were a bunch of you that were interested in the stop signs. What I would highly recommend you do is why don't you post your interest on the bulletin board that we have on our Blackboard site. And that way you could all work together. To an extent you can work together, okay, but you can all use the same data. And then the person who gets the best results in that data will get the A. The next one will get the B. Then we'll have the C. Then, you know, D, E, F. No, I'm just kidding. But there's nothing wrong with having a shared database. The whole class is sharing databases. And I see a bunch of that. Okay? Any questions? I will post the midterm project grades. Those are Scott's. Mine, I'm still working on. Mine will be more multidimensional than Scott's. His right now look like letter grades, A, B, C, plus or minus. Mine will consist of a 2-page paper review form, plus written comments on your form. By the way, would you like me to post the papers to a file that you can look at what other people have done? I wouldn't put the grade on it. But it would be very easy for me to make a PDF of the papers. And you could just go through them. All I have to do is stick them through my scanner. It's that little 4-letter word called ABET that's really been messing me up. I have them lying on the floor and I was going to stick them through the scanner. I'll put your grades on first, then I'll scan. How's that? And I do have the sound file. I got another new program to try. will make podcasting easier. And it was free. Okay. But yes, I'll get the grades. I'll get the scant notes. That's usually very trivial. And, I'm making the very strong suggestion, if some of you can use a common database, it doesn't have to be restricted to the images we've taken. And, if we don't have enough stop signs and stuff, I think the class can easily together come up with a bunch of pictures or go to Google and come up with a bunch. If you have questions about your database, just make a quick print out of thumbnails, 10 or 20 images to a page, and just bring it by and have me look at it, or make a PDF and just email it to me. Not one image per page. Put a bunch per page. Okay? Questions? John? Oh, I knew I forgot something. Say, can you send me a really threatening email, and I will look that up and send it out? I just know it's a teen, and I can't remember which one. And I keep meaning to look it up, and again, I keep getting sidetracked by this ABET garbage. Well, and that's right about where I want it. I didn't want it to be the 8th. I want it to be the middle of the exam period, and I can't remember what the date was. Does it? What day of the week is that? Okay, I'll take a look. I might make it a little later. Because I would probably make it a Friday, which would give you more time. Let me take a look, though. Now, if you want to get it done earlier, I would be very happy with that. Because I don't want to be here on the 22nd or 23rd turning in my grades. Okay. So, any questions on the project? Anything you want me to do? John, big email, bold type, all uppercase. It won't impact your grade. No, no problem. No problem. I've just been so overwhelmed with that ABET stuff that... Yeah, send it right now. Yeah, you can even set up a cron job and send them, well, not every 1 minute, but something reasonable. I guess that's what it takes. I'll just take a minute, but I want to run videos for you. I have not seen some of these. There's a lot of traffic lights. There are a lot of automotive taillights in these. There's a lot of really nice stretches. I'm not quite sure where it was taken. Almost looks like it could be Monticello.
The first step is going east on Fairmont.
Is it?
Through the
Okay, well, you're ahead of me. If anyone, and it's almost irrelevant where they all are. I'm loading them up right now.
Some of them are
really tricky. Well, it also looks like bad weather. Okay. Let's take a look at these fairly quickly. Because there's 20,000. I'm not quite sure how we're going to distribute them. Bill came around and copied the entire DVD. Or CD. Sorry. Didn't mean to get you that worried. Okay. I'm not sure where that is.
Yeah, this is the one I couldn't.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, for some of you that have talked to me about color, notice that you could use this as a color reference. If you properly calibrated this, it would be a very interesting way. There's a big stop sign over there. Could you recognize it? lots of headlights and taillights. Pedestrians.
This is my favorite. It's coming right in.
Right about here. Now, yes, could you ensure that you would not run over those people? Lots of lines. I mean, from the pavement viewpoint, this is really good right here. There's another stop. Center in Mayfield, is it?
Yeah, it's the Plaza with Target and all the
music. Okay, okay. But, let's see. That was one short one. Okay. For some reason, I've got to talk to Scott. My software didn't like him leaving blanks in the file numbers, so it wouldn't make movies.
The other big problem I have here is when, because of the file naming convention used for the system, watching it was a real pain in the butt, because I'd get to, like, you know, image 1,000, and then it would jump to image 10,000, which had 5
yes.
instead of 4.
Yes.
So
it was not a good naming convention, and we can blame Scott for that. If someone wants to write a simple little macro to change them, and by the way, we've got some excellent pictures of taillights. I think it's. Is it? I wasn't sure.
There's a line or two up in this, like, top 13% that keeps dropping out.
Okay, but here's some, like, great. Yeah, by the way, notice the lights were changing, but look at that. They didn't look, does that even look red up there? You know, I'm telling you that your color, your recognition of traffic lights is going to be very challenging. Traffic signs, a lot better. There's tons of good road surface, though. There's tons of cars in the adjacent lane. Lots of lanes. Notice, this one, there's no way you even get a good edge marker. Maybe you could recognize, newspaper boxes or something. But
if you can read the street signs, I think
that should be. If you can read the street signs, that would definitely be extra credit. Yes. So. But notice, you've got some really good long driving sequences here. And it lets you start to get a feel for how big the ramp. Notice the lights. That was documented. I don't know if Scott was driving or not. Oh, look at this. We even make turns. You know, should we use the lights of the car in front? Oh, look again. So there's lots and lots of line markers, all of that kind of stuff. And notice how you can just get overwhelmed with oncoming lights. You know, they bloom. And if they're far away, they just look huge. Notice also the difference between the ground and the sky. And, you know, one of the things that's been talked about that Scott would like to have is how do you determine the horizon? And I don't know if that's Interstate 271 right there or not, but you don't usually have overpasses with moving cars to mark the horizon. But that's a good project in itself, finding the horizon. Now let's accelerate life here. Okay, let's just go through fast. And by the way, notice we've got some bridge stuff there again. Really good stuff. Oh, and we've got some cars cutting lanes in front of us. There's some good long stretches. I don't think we're going to have... This is probably more like the kind of traffic density we would have as opposed to this. And by the way, there was one in here that was really the right color. That one's actually green. And then there we saw another one turn green. So just to show you those, let's see. Now here's the I think traffic lights are better in these, and we don't go through red ones very much. But these are probably modestly typical urban stuff. But we'd need more buildings for it to be urban, but that's okay. But notice lane changes. Okay. Good enough. Now, here's an interesting one, if I remember right. Now, if you can recognize the turn signs and stuff, that would be great. But watch what's going to happen. If I recall, we make a turn here, and think about how you reacquire lane markers after a turn. Well, I guess we don't. One of these we turn. Oh, was it? That's what happens. Oh, you're right. Yeah, see, that's a good one. You know, how do you avoid from ramming the red car while you're doing this? But see, reacquiring or even picking up reference during a turn might be useful. Okay. And nice open stretches. Don't hit the bus. And there are more traffic lights. Again, green. More green. Stopping for a car in front of you. There's a lot more images. I'm not sure, though, how much all of them are usable. Okay, and this is the first set. This looks like, although I'm not sure, that the road is wet. Actually, is that rain? Might be. Okay. Oh, notice. Speed limit 20 signs. I don't think that would be required in the competition either. But there's some really nice straight sections. Very good. Ah, okay, because I haven't even looked at some of these. Let's see. Traffic circle. Oh, yes. Yes, yes, we're going to be coming up on the dreaded traffic circle. It's possible, but you probably want to use one camera for multiple purposes. And that includes, aside from the lines, you probably want to pick up traffic and other things. I'm going to talk about a lot of these related things today. Now, I would be very impressed if someone could use a program to recognize the cars by model and type. Now, here's a great one, identifying a parked vehicle in your lane. That would be a real coup, because that is something that is almost certain to happen in the challenge. Something in your lane. And in fact, I'm going to show you some Fourier transform techniques, I hope, today for detecting moving vehicles. And Well, this is for other things. You'll see. But yes, actually, one thought is, how about a neural net that would recognize car model colors? Of course, you know, since all of the vehicles will probably, well, I don't know. You know, Stanford will probably have Stanley, which would be factory colors, and I don't know how many of the vehicles will be factory colors. Oh, okay. We're almost to the traffic circle. And by the way, notice the really different texture. There's leaves. I'm not sure that we would have leaves on the side of the road. Oh, and water. Look at that. Look at the reflection, the glare that you get. Yes, the traffic circle is, I think, one more stop sign away. Notice those stop signs. People are very, very good at picking them up a long way away. And notice another stopped vehicle or two. Well, I guess he decided to pull away. The next thing is the traffic circle. This is a three-lane wide traffic circle. The innermost lane is a turn lane. Notice we're going to be in the middle lane. And the guy pulls in front of us. Okay. Now, that's okay. Now, the other side of the intersection, I don't know if he's going to keep going straight on Fairmont. Okay. Because the inside lane, this one, has to turn right when it goes straight. This one can go straight or turn right. And one of the most common problems is people that get into the wrong lane and don't know what they're doing. See, right here, and you're going to turn here. Some people use turn signals, some people don't. There's where someone hit me once. And then right up Fairmont. Usually there's cars parked along the right, but not today, I guess. Oh, and all orange barrels! I was hoping we had some orange barrels. Those might be very common in the DARPA challenge. And then that's it. So, we've got a lot of images. If you see something you want, if you have an intent of using these, let me know, and then I'll work harder to get it up faster. But with 20,000 of them, I don't know how big it is, and I'm not sure how well it'll work. Any questions, comments? And Bill commented, apparently our video has a little problem, a jitter of one line up and down. So no comments, no questions. You're all intimidated by those videos? I'm not exactly sure for the urban challenge. The horizon is actually very, very useful for flying robots. And at pretty much, if you're into UAVs, which are these unmanned aerial vehicles, one of the major things is detecting the horizon so that you can get your, let's see, I guess that's your, I never can get roll, pitch, and yaw proper. I never remember which one's which, but that's so you can get your roll and probably pitch. But horizon is a very big deal in flying robots. Scott is very interested in it. If nothing else, knowing where the horizon is would tell you where to crop. You probably want to crop at the horizon and only look at what's below it for purposes of driving.
If you are coming up on a hill, you'll see the horizon rise before you get onto the hill, so it will tell you instead to not look 3 feet ahead of you, but instead to look up in the picture.
Okay.
And if you do things like automatic lane line predictions of like only looking a certain part of the image for lane lines, you're on the horizon, that's going to converge. And it's also a new problem after you get up to the top of the hill and start coming down. If you're looking up into the sky,
okay, but if you are interested in a particular group of pictures, that we're going to need additional pictures, I will use the self-organizing approach, use the bulletin board. Say you want to do stop signs, and you know that way you guys can all share your stop sign images. You know, that'll make life easier for you. Okay? Now, I said I wasn't going to do it the last time, but I think I'm going to try and do it. I want to do all of Chapter 10 in 45 minutes. Okay? It turns out you've actually already seen a considerable amount of Chapter 10. There is a different perspective, though, on doing things. Okay, so this is the mask that we've been using all through spatial image processing, usually a 3x3, but it doesn't have to be. The idea is that what we can do is we can view it as more of a correlation than any kind of spatial mask or anything. And the idea is, as we slide our mask over the image, we're going to get a response, which is nothing more than the template times the picture, corresponding picture elements, okay? And what we do, we will construct these templates by putting positive numbers, which correspond to the object we're looking for. We're going to put negative numbers, like that. And the idea is that we'll just compute the R, and if R is greater than a threshold, then we'll give it a 1, else a 0. So this can be an edge finder, it can be a core, it can find more complex shapes, but it's a slightly different way of looking at it. It is not the direct analog of what we were doing in spatial filtering. Okay, and here's one that looks a little bit like a Laplacian, okay, but it's very positive, all negative around it, okay, that's a mask for finding positive pixels, okay, you will get a large response out of that only when it matches and finds a 1, and it turns out this is a picture of a turbine blade, and there's a porosity there, and they claim there's a black dot right there. And this would be the result of running a filter over it, and I think that's thresholding it. Yes. Now, so that's if you want to look for a black point, or I'm sorry, a white point, that's the way of doing it. And by the way, the reason you use positive and negative is that if it's a uniform background, this filter or this template will give you 0. A common thing to do is to pick your threshold equal to the largest or the brightest value in the image. So usually that might be like 255. It doesn't have to be, but That's a good just first approximation. Now, you can look for all kinds of things. These are ways of looking at the math that we've done before in this correlation manner. Suppose you wanted to look for horizontal lines. Okay, this would be a good template for finding horizontal. Suppose you want to find a line along a 45-degree diagonal. This would be good. A vertical, a minus 45-degree diagonal. You know, if you stop and think about it, variants of this are good for doing things like finding lane markers. Okay, here's one working on an ICNAS, a wire bond image. Okay, and this is binary wire bond. We process it with a minus 45 degree. This is the absolute value. Okay, there's some positive and negative stuff in there. This is the result of thresholding it, and you see you get the minus 45. Okay. I didn't do the thresholding in that middle image. Mm-hmm. And that's probably because we did it for a single width. But I'm not sure on that. Now, edges. This is actually an interesting thing we should have talked about earlier. Okay, this is our ideal edge. Okay, how about if we have a gray level profile of an edge? And by the way, this is a good application for a neural net type thing. You know, to us, that's a pretty good edge. On the image, okay, it fades in and out. Okay, you've got a continuous grayscale variation. Okay, you take derivatives. Now, this actually has a fuzzy edge. It's got a grayscale profile. What do the derivatives look like? You know, you're going to get a nice response at the edge with a derivative, first derivative. Second derivative will give you two spikes. What's this look like in noise? Whoa, no, okay, here's what we just looked at. We just add a little bit of noise, and you don't really see any change here in the way it looks like in the image. But look at what starts to happen now in the first and second derivative. Oh, the second derivative is already knocked out with just a little noise. First derivative is okay. We add more noise, and, you know, physically, this still looks like a great image. The first derivative is really suffering. Second derivative is eliminated. And we add now, and, you know, think about it. In experimental data, if you've looked at one horizontal line in your image, is that an unreasonable amount of noise? No. You could have that much intensity variation going across something. In fact, your road surfaces are probably worse than that. And look at what happens when you do a first and a second derivative. It's basically gone. You've seen all of these before, except now, instead of we had zeros and ones, notice the emphasis is always the pluses and the minuses, the pre-wit we've seen before. Some of you used Roberts to good effect in your midterm project, because that was one that had diagonals in it. But what we did earlier, you know, these are derivative operators. You can tell immediately because it's got a positive, a zero, and a minus usually. The correlation operators, we just used a few slides earlier, they tended to be positive for the object we were looking for, and usually they used a larger number than one. And then we had negatives where we didn't want that in the area of the template that was not the object. So you can construct templates really easily. But these are just the derivatives. What I want to point out is, and this is actually a great little set of pictures, most of you did not filter your images. Okay? And this is actually looks like a university building or a church with a lot of bricks in it. Okay? That means lots of texture. And we've done a horizontal gradient, a vertical gradient. Now, I don't know if they used the Sobel for this or whatever. I couldn't find it in our textbook, but I bet GWE actually indicates which operator they use. But the key thing is, since this is a horizontal, notice how it's picking up all the brick texture. Over here, this is picking up the strong vertical lines. That's what you expect. Okay. And then here is the estimated gradient that you've done before. You know, magnitude of the gradient in X, magnitude of the gradient in Y, just add them together. And, you know, that puts out a lot of detail, probably a little too much texture. You know, you'd just like maybe get the outlines. Here's what happens. This is smoothed. The original image is smoothed with a 5x5 averaging filter. And same thing done again. And notice, much less texture, simple lines, you may want to filter. It's not a hard thing. That was just with 5x5. This is the result of using, let me see what my notes are. Those are 45 degrees. They might be Sobels. Yes, they are Sobels. Okay. And I think that would probably be a 2. Let's see what they were actually using. Okay, so that's your Sobel. Positive over here, negative over here, so that's the plus 45, and I flip it around, okay, to get the minus 45. Okay, like that. Again, that's fairly close to the kind of thing you might want to be doing. The Laplacian. Those are standard Laplacian masks. However, what an awful lot of people do, and I passed this, I think, over quickly back when we were doing the filtering, this is the Laplacian of a Gaussian. It's also called the Mexican hat operator, the sombrero operator, and a bunch of things because it sort of looks like a hat. Okay? This would be the corresponding mask. You notice it's bigger than a 3x3. That's because it's a Gaussian with the second derivative operator, which would look like this. What is the effect of the Gaussian? It really smooths it out a bit more. It makes it bigger. And that's one way to do your filtering and stuff together. The big question is, do you want to ever use a second derivative, a Laplacian? Maybe not, because you saw how sensitive it is to noise earlier. You know, here now is a medical imaging. A lot of stuff came out of medical imaging. Let me check my notes here on which image is what. Okay. The first one's the original grayscale image. They used a 27x27 mask. Again, 27x27 Gaussian filter to smooth it. Okay, this is a Sobel gradient, and I assume that what they did is it's the square root of the Sobel in the X squared plus the Sobel in the Y squared. They don't say that they approximated it. They show you what their 27x27 smoothing mask looked like. That's their Laplacian. It's only 3x3. This is 27x27. Okay. This is the result of running both operators. Okay. That was the Sobel gradient. Okay. This is the Laplacian of the gradient. I'm sorry, the Laplacian of the Gaussian. Run on that. This is the threshold version of this. You know, you might want to do an LOG, one of these Laplacian of Gaussians, maybe look for road edges or something. Threshold it, and what they do then is they run a gradient over it again to find the edges. Now, this is more biological stuff. High resolution, they might be wanting to approximate the edges, or they might be wanting to measure dimensions. Like a very common thing is measuring the size of heart valves, things like that. Automatic steam. Now, this next one, you've seen the image before. Remember, our author was involved with Perceptic, and they were the first people to do the license plate recognition, probably for the automatic radar. But what's really going on here is this is an X gradient, this is a Y gradient, probably Sobel, but they do something called edge length to get really, really good edges. This is something you could do with traffic lane markers. What is edge linking? Well, it's sort of similar to what I called relaxation before. Okay? What they did is they want, basically, the results here are zeros or ones. Okay? Based upon these, which are grayscale. Okay? And the idea is, if the gradient magnitude is somewhat similar, i.e., if we look at two adjacent pixels, and if their difference in the magnitude is less than some threshold, then they're part of an edge, and you give both of them a one. Okay? There has to be, that they have to be above a certain basic threshold to begin with. Okay. It's really, that has to occur in the first place. And that's where you'd probably threshold both of these to get your candidates. Then, if there's not too much difference, you know, it could be that your gradient is going down in amplitude, but you say, because I'm next to an edge, I'm likely to be an edge. But there's a second factor. The gradient gives you a direction. So, if I'm looking at two adjacent pixels, if the intensities are, if the magnitude of the derivatives are not too dissimilar, and the direction of the derivatives is in approximately the same direction, then I say, oh, those are probably both part of the same edge. Okay? And one thing that you could perhaps do, and I didn't see anyone do it, in their midterm, is if you stop and think about it, if you're looking at lane markers like this, and if you find one here, then you sort of have a pretty good idea where to look over here. And you could say, if I find something here that looks like one, and I find something here that is maybe a little weaker but looks like one, what you can do is raise the probabilities or the intensities of both and say, hey, I'm going to set both of these to 1 if the difference between these two that are separated by the right distance for length markers is correct. Now, I went through that pretty quickly, and it sounded complicated, but it isn't. It's really saying, if these were lanes, okay, if I find one point here and it is a lane, then the probability is pretty high of finding a point here. And if I'd look at it the other way, and there are ways then to use two sides of the road instead of just one. And this part you've seen all before. This is the Huff transform. And you remember all of that. And there's the famous one with the infrared image, and it finds the road surf or the edges of the road based upon the infrared. Now, this is something that people really, really get a lot into. This is graph searching. And I wish I could write on this, but what it is imagine these are the centers of pixels. So really what we're looking at is something like this. And these all have coordinates. I think it's 1, 1, 1, 2, 2, 1, etc. But if you pick two points P and Q, we can come up with the cost of an edge. Okay, we call that C. It's dependent upon the two coordinates, and it can be a horizontal or a vertical, and I draw it with an arrowhead because it has a direction. I'm going down, so I'm going to have a right and a left, and it's going to be equal to the maximum value minus the right hand minus the left hand. And this is just the maximum pixel value. The whole idea is, okay, these are your grayscale values. What I want to do to follow an edge is, and the classic example is you start at the top and you get it and you go to the bottom. The cost is always the lowest where there's a sharp difference. Okay? A big difference. So you want to sort of find the path. In a way, this is a little bit like canning. You want to find the path that gives you the lowest cost, i.e., it's the one that follows the largest derivative changes, or the largest changes, which means the largest derivatives as you go down. Now, you can compute them by that formula over there. If these are the actual grayscale values, you can see, okay, it's light over here. It's a little light over here, so it looks like we might have something that's light going there, and it's dark up here, and dark, little darker down here. Okay? Actually, I probably should have said, this is bright here, dark here, bright here. Okay? Now, I can compute costs just like this, and notice, I have a left cost and a right cost. And the idea is to find edges in pictures. I can start at the top with the lowest cost, which would be 2, and then simply follow the lowest cost path until I reach the bottom of the image. Or I come back to myself. And so you can see here I pick the lowest cost, that's a 2. I'm looking at an 8 versus a 0. I can't go through the 6, that's in the wrong direction. So it's 8 and 0. I come down here, I see that I have a 1 and a 9, so I go that way, and I have basically a 1 here. So you can do graph math, or graph searching. People really, really get into this, and you can do all kinds of very fancy optimization problems. And I'm not going to talk too much about graphs. You get arcs and nodes. This shows the set of all possible paths, and this actually shows the low-cost path that we followed. Okay. If you really get into image processing and computer vision, I usually make my students take a course in graph theory. Very useful. This is actually a chromosome silhouette that was done by graph searching. Now, usually you had to sort of give it an edge to start from, or it had to look for an edge that is a sufficiently large gradient. But using the graph searching, this white line here is the line that it followed. And that's with the key point is these are with fuzzy edges that are noisy. By picking the cost, we're really trying to find the lowest cost or the best approximation in a noisy environment where the edge really is. Okay. Now, segmentation by thresholding. This is good for grayscale images. And technically, you can do it for color if you're working on each color plane. And it's very good when you get stuff like this, which is bimodal. But when you get a multimodal thing like that, it's really very difficult. How could you get one of those? Pretty easily. Look at this example. This is a very interesting... Remember the homomorphic filter that we talked about, and we separated the incoming illumination from the reflectance function of the object? That's what we're going to do here. This is the reflectance. So if I just shined light from like our projector back there on this and it came back, and you can see there's a very nice clean, it's darker here, that would correspond to this distribution. This is a histogram of that. So this would correspond to the background, and this right here would correspond to the object. And that's easily separable right there. No problem. Now, let's suppose that it was illuminated with a light from an angle. You might have something like this to illuminate it. So it's bright over here. It gets dark over here. So imagine I have maybe a light bulb inside a shade, or a spotlight, or a flashlight. Bright there, dark there. This is the illumination function. So if I actually reflected this, what would it look like? Well, it doesn't look like it's that bad. This is the product. Darker over here, lighter over here. But notice what happens to the histogram. It gets totally messed up. Now, I have to put in a plug here. I think Andy may be the only one that will pick up on it. Papoulos. Anyone know that famous name, Papoulos? Okay, you have to take Leparo's statistics course. But it turns out that what happens if we do this and represent it as the product of an illumination and a reflectance. And remember what we did with the homomorphic was we took the log and separated it. It turns out what that does is it convolves the histogram of the two. So I didn't show a histogram of this, but it's going to be like a slant. Okay? Could be a uniform distribution or whatever. But this, the histogram of this will convolve with the histogram of this. They're both probability density functions, and you get this mess. So, a good technique, and it's really a good one, but only works primarily if you're working in industry. You know, suppose I'm inspecting stuff on an assembly line or something. I might know the illumination function. I can measure it. I can take my image, divide it at every point by this and get this. So if you want to impress your boss, that's a good technique. You calibrate your lighting very, very well and then basically remove the effects of lighting. Now, as some of you found out, I think, in your midterm projects, a single threshold will work for stuff like this. I don't know what parts those are for. They just look like tools, or I'm not sure what they are. But the histogram, very nice, big area in the middle. You put your threshold someplace in here, no problem. That'd be great. Okay? And actually, here's an image that we've seen before. Okay? And this is actually, well, one of the things is, how do you come up with automatic methods of estimating threshold? How many of you sat there in your midterm and played with, or on some of the previous projects and played with, where do you put the threshold to get the best looking image? One of the ways that you can do it is, take a look at that histogram right there. That's it's a grayscale image, but basically it's two classes. You've got the black line, you've got the white or gray background. Okay? One of the things is, and this is a simple automatic thresholding. Actually, one person did the Otsu method. I forgot who that was. Okay. That was in Harlech. Did you look find that in Harlech and Shapiro?
No, I found a
Okay, but this is somewhat related. This is simpler than Otsu. People have sought automatic methods of thresholding stuff for a long time. Okay. what they'll do here is, okay, one, threshold your image. With T0. An initial threshold. A good initial threshold, take your darkest, take your lightest, average it, take the one in the middle. Okay, threshold the image. Two, compute the average grayscale for all zeros. In other words, everything that was below the threshold got converted to a zero. Wherever it was in here, go in here and find its actual grayscale value and find out what was the average intensity of all the pixels that got converted to zero. Okay? Do the same thing for the ones. And that would give you mu 2. 3. T1 equals the average. Go through and do it again now with T1. Basically, do this until the change in threshold. In other words, that's a quick way. This works for images in which you know you have only two classes, background and object. Okay? But that's a way of automating things. And you have to admit, we processed that by morphological. We opened and closed it, remember? And, you know, this still has a lot of little dots in it, so it didn't remove that. It just converted it to binary. Now, other things which can be done. Anyone ever heard of quad trees? Oh, not very many computers. Okay. One of the things that you can do is you can start cutting images up into smaller and smaller images. Now, you remember this. This is our illuminated object where we had the crummy illumination a couple slides back. And this is what happens. Remember the histogram of the illuminated object was, I can't remember, it was something like that. And the natural thing that you would do is pick the threshold right there in that little valley. But remember, that little valley is because it got smeared out due to the uneven illumination. Okay, so what happens when you pick this global threshold? If you pick that, you get that. That's not a very good result. You missed the whole rest of the object here. And you see, because you did your computation over the entire image, okay, you had a lot of difficulty dealing with the left and the right differently. The standard technique is to actually break your image up into sub-images. And I think you can see the lines here. Standard would be to go in powers of 2 or 4. Here we went in powers of 4. So we did a 4x4 grid, developed it into sub-images. Okay? And then the idea is within each sub-image, then what you do is you do a histogram and, oh, I erased my threshold algorithm. You can run that automatic threshold algorithm, and it does a nice job. It picks up most of the edges, but notice where it failed. These two sub-areas, sub-images, and why? Because notice, there's only a little tiny bit of background, And again, there's only a little tiny bit of background. So it really threw things off. Okay? Now, what you can do, if you knew enough about the images, is you could go in and further subdivide. You see, this is the one that gave us the trouble. This was a good one. Okay, so we were just at the 4x4. Okay, so that was one of the four. Let me back up. I think I may be confusing you. I'm looking here and here. Those are the two that we're looking at. Okay. And that one has a nice, well-behaved histogram. This one is all mushed together. It's unimodal. What you can do is further subdivide it, and you can get histograms now in this little one that look like this. If you know that there is an edge there, there are ways you just keep subdividing. Now, since you use the Otsu algorithm, I'm just going to say a tiny bit. I'm not going to derive it, okay? But I'm going to give you just a little hint of what it's all about. If you have two probabilities that would correspond to one of these mushed together histograms, okay, the idea is, okay, and for the biology types, it's really the total probability of error. You know, given this one, that's your error probability. Given this one, this is your error probability. So the integral of this in here is your total error. And basically, it ends up being the probability, let's see, this is going to be 1, this will be 2, P2 will be the overall probability of this event happening, this will be the area under that curve, okay, it's a function of T, this is the threshold, I don't know where to pick the T. The other term is P1 E2 of T. That's the, let's see, P1, and the error would be this side. So that's my total error, and we're all good engineers and scientists. What do you want to do? Minimize the total error as a function of T. So del error, del T. What's commonly done is you model this distribution and that distribution by a Gaussian. We use Gaussians for everything. Okay? So you fit a Gaussian to that, you put it in here, you calculate these, you do the derivative, you set it equal to 0, and find the t. And that gets close to giving you the Otsu. Now, you never would have probably come up with this on your own. And if the two have the same variance, you get an approximation that looks like this. You know, this could be the probability of a yellow line, the probability of a background. You could relate it definitely to what we're doing. Okay. Medical image processing. This is where you can actually do things like compute statistically compute thresholds. This one's done in a very wild manner. The idea is that you actually want, this is actually a cardioangiogram, and it's really important to come up with an estimate of the edges. So that what you can do is, and I think that's the valve right there, so you can estimate that area. And let me tell you, you look at that, can you even figure out where the edges of the area are? And, you know, doctors and stuff really want analytical techniques so they can determine if you're sick. So this is an X-ray of the heart after it's been injected with chemicals. Okay? They will take an image beforehand to get a picture of the spinal cord as well. They'll do an image subtraction to get rid of the spinal cord. And then the big thing is, how can you find the edges? What they'll do is they'll take several of these X-rays to average them together and get rid of the noise. And then they're going to divide them. But they're going to do their subdivision a little bit differently. Instead of doing what we did before, which was they were completely orthogonal, we're going to have them 50% overlap. So the new tiles are going to be on top of each other. So there will be one here, then I put the next one 50% on top. There's 50% overlap, and I can fit 49 64 by 64 sub-images in there. Okay? And then what you do is you look in each sub-image. And sub-images are going to, for example, look like this, with mushy or fuzzy thresholds, and they actually came through, they fit Gaussian functions to the data, they actually came over and did this, they estimated the optimum threshold for each sub-image, they calculated all of those, so you'd have 49 thresholds. Then, because they don't want them changing too abruptly from each sub-image to the other, they interpolated adjacent thresholds. In effect, they averaged them. So you have a threshold, you have a 7x7, you have 49 different thresholds, but by doing that averaging of adjacent ones, it makes sure there's no abrupt change in the threshold. And sounds like an awful, awful lot of work. And it is. But doctors really get into these kinds of things for analyzing diseases, or actually this would be more of a problem, but notice how nice a job it did on something that in that original image, I mean you can sort of vaguely see it there, and you can imagine there would be a lot of, if a human would come there and draw it, there'd be a lot, well, each human would draw it differently. And the idea is to come up with something that's always the same, that we can actually compare things analytically from patient to patient. Now, this is completely different. This is now handwriting analysis done by IBM, and these are three-level images. I mean, this looks really weird because it's a computer printout, but what we have are zeros, minuses, and pluses. And what's going on is we're looking at the gradient, okay, and the derivative, okay. And if the derivative is less than a threshold, there's no change, and we put a zero, okay. If the derivative is going positive, and the second derivative is above a threshold, that means we think it's really changing, we give it a plus. Okay. First derivative increasing, second up the Laplacian also up there. The negative is just simply going the other way. Okay. And actually, I may have my colors here backwards, but the whole idea is if you take a look, this is actually a handwritten line, you know, probably with a pencil or a pen on a background. And notice you've got the derivative in effect going up. It may level off or start coming down. Okay, so the idea is by having this three-level image, where do you have a line? When it goes up and comes back down. That's the key thing. And what you do is you look for going up and coming back down horizontally, going up and coming back down vertically. and that would determine where a line is. And this can be really, really powerful. Here is a crummy check. Yeah, well, I don't mean that it's really crummy, but I mean that, look at that, it's got some kind of colored background on it. You know, a picture of a mountain or, I don't know, cows or something. And, you know, it's hard to pull out, and I noticed that they didn't pull out the signature, okay, which would have been there. But look at the really nice job that this algorithm did on pulling out the writing. Very nice, because you're saying each line has to have a positive slope and a negative slope and maybe an inflection period in the middle. That could be something that would work very nice for lane markers, potentially. Works really well with nasty backgrounds. This is actually what they did, is they plotted all the gradients in the image, and this is where they picked their threshold for whether it was a positive or a negative. Okay. This is just color histogramming and segmentation. That's what we've all seen. Well, I think we've all seen this image before. It's a fairly common one in image processing. I think it is. She has a red star, and these are facial tones. This is basically what you've done already. In fact, what many of you did for the midterm on, you know, are the yellows close to yellows? If they are close to your prototype, you gave it a 1. Otherwise, it was all 0. If it was close to red, you gave it a 1. Otherwise, it was all 0. This is just color thresholding. Nothing fancy. But what does segmentation actually do? And how do you find the edges of these things? Okay. You have to include connectivity. You know, a lot of you just did, is the RGB close? What you didn't do is say, is this RGB value close to the adjacent one? Is it close to a yellow? And is it connected to one that is a really good yellow? You see, all of those things reinforce each other. And that's basically what they did here. This is, if you remember, a long time ago, this was an X-ray weld. And that was a crack in a weld. But what they did is they simply said, okay, let's start with all of the really bright pixels. And we'll use them as potential locations, maybe for a lane marker, in this case for a cracked weld. And then they said, what we will do, and you notice these are bigger, I'm going to look at the adjacent pixels. I'm going to think that these are a weld. I'll look down here. If the brightness is close to this and it's connected to it, I'm going to call it a weld. So you see, you initially come up with seed points and then you grow them out. You don't just threshold everything, or you don't just segment based upon the distance between the color you think it is. You make it more of a difference and a growing approach. And this, by the way, is nothing more than the edges of this put on top of that image. And it doesn't look too bad. But that might be something some of you might find handy for lane marking. And by the way, that's what the histogram of it looked like. You know, you would not very readily, based upon that previous discussion we had, you know, when you have a smeared histogram like that, you're not going to be able to pick a good threshold. This, we didn't really threshold. We just picked the brightest. That's segmentation. You've got topology. And let's see. Yeah, I've got 12 more. Darn it, I couldn't do the whole chapter in 45 minutes. I am disappointed. If I wouldn't have shown you those videos, I could have done it. So I'm going to stop there, turn off the recorder.